It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll walk through the unemployment legislation being considered in Congress this week.
First, the economics blog 24/7 Wall Street recently published a list of the 10 worst-run cities in America, which was also featured in the Huffington Post. And Wisconsin's largest city, Milwaukee, made the list, coming in at number 10.
The report took into account things like poverty, education, crime, and city credit rating. We've talked with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett in the past, and he's made the case for his accomplishments in the city.
Today, we'll get another perspective on how well the city of Milwaukee runs with Milwaukee-based columnist Eugene Kane. And we're also happy to hear from you on this one. If you have an opinion on the matter, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Eugene, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Good to talk to you.
Well, what did you think when you saw 24/7 Wall Street had Milwaukee as the 10th worst-run city on their list?
Well, I have to tell you, my first reaction as a journalist is to wonder, well, what is 24/7 Wall Street? I mean, it is cited as the source of this study, and I have to be honest and say I hadn't really heard of it before. But at the same time, I've dealt over the years with various worst lists that include Milwaukee. Usually, in my experience, it has been in terms of social indicators that negatively affect the African-American community. But this one seems to be a blanket indictment of the city as a whole as being worse run. So that kind of raised my eyebrows. And then looking over the list, it just seemed to be a very interesting mix of cities, including some cities much bigger than Milwaukee. I think Cleveland, Detroit would qualify. And then some other smaller cities, even out in California, like San Bernardino and
that was the worst one, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that flagged me about San Bernardino is that they were involved in a big corruption scandal a couple years ago, but that was San Bernardino County. So I guess I'm at a loss to explain exactly what the criteria. You're always at a loss to figure out when they publish these lists, what is their real main criteria?
Well, I know some of the indicators they were looking at, debt was one, crime was another, GDP another, things like that. And I wonder if you want to address a few of those in terms of...
Well, I do think the reason it has some credibility is that if you want to point out the most damaging social indicators or issues in Milwaukee, hey, poverty, education, crime, unemployment, you're hitting that right on the nail. Whether it's for the black community or the larger community. I mean, those are paramount issues in this town. And the fact that Milwaukee is included in a study that also includes cities much larger than we are, like Midwestern cities like Cleveland and Detroit, that gives you a sense that, yeah, maybe this is an issue that needs to be addressed because we're kind of finishing real high in these real bad categories. So I think a lot of people will respond to that, that if the reason Milwaukee is listed as the 10th worst run city is because of the way we handle things like poverty, education, and crime, and unemployment, yeah, I think a lot of people agree with that.
Now, poverty is one that Mayor Barrett has weighed in on in regard specifically to this list, and he said, yeah, you got us on that one. We need to do better, and we're working on it. When it comes to debt, that's one that he has taken issue with and sort of defended Milwaukee. Do you want to speak to the debt issue in Milwaukee?
Well, I'm sure from his perspective, you know, the mayor is looking at it, you know, from a top-down perspective that he has experts and people on his staff who have analyzed this. And again, it's this whole ranking us against other cities that creates these sort of, you know, lists that create a lot of anxiety and I guess even debate about the way this is happening. But I think the best way is to talk to people in Milwaukee. As a journalist, I've talked to people in Milwaukee from different classes, different income levels, and the people on the bottom do cite this as being a particularly bad city. Again, I will admit that I'm talking specifically myself about African Americans I've talked to, that this is a hard place for a black man to be unemployed. It's a hard place for a black family to, you know, to earn a livable income that will allow them to, you know, to sort of enjoy the things in life that hardworking people should enjoy. So these are all things that I think the mayor is probably defensive about, but I think he also acknowledges in terms of things about raising the minimum wage, and there are things Milwaukee could do to make it more livable for people on those bottom scales.
Well, so living in Milwaukee, you said you're a journalist, you're out there talking to people, you live in the city. Does it feel like Milwaukee is a poorly run city to you?
I think it's a peculiar, I think I would say it's a very peculiar city in terms of the way certain institutions work, and I could even go to something as basic as outside parking regulations. I mean, I had a recent talk with people who asked me why, you know, Milwaukee has a system where you have to pay money to park outside your home on the streets. And that's something very peculiar to Milwaukee, and I don't know if that falls in the category of that means it's worse run, but I do think talking to people, they do think other cities do things better than they do here in Milwaukee, which is, I think, is the intent of a survey like this, worst run, best run. I think that's all on account of what citizens think or residents think. Can things be done better? Crime? I mean, I think people accept the fact that Milwaukee is not as safe a city as it should be, given the resources we have to battle crime and the things we could do to prevent crime. So that's what I think is an interesting way for them to frame this list, best or worst run cities. And living in Milwaukee day to day, I don't see it as a totally badly run city, but I do see peculiar things that happen that make you think, well, maybe we could address this a little differently, whether it's transportation issues or racial issues or government issues, taxing issues.
Well, let's get our callers in on this. We've got Nate with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was going to point out two things, and I'm arguably a defender of Milwaukee at the moment, because if you're talking about the social impacts like poverty, one of the things that I think should be brought up is that Milwaukee is part of a metro area. And without recognizing how well the communities within a metro area work together or choose not to work together, you're actually not measuring how well the city itself is run. And the city itself, I would say, and maybe you brought this up a little bit, faced some financial hard spots, and I think came through them reasonably well, which someone could actually say is a measure of how well the city is run. And so the study may be mislabeled or mistitled.
All right. Interesting points there, Nate. So what do you make of that, Eugene?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's just a weird, maybe not weird, but it's a peculiar way to frame the study, what's best run and worst run, and then you use things like the credit rating, poverty, education, crime, unemployment, and the regional GDP, and they don't really give much of an explanation as to why these things account to whether the city is run well or not. Because it seems to me poverty, crime, education, these are a lot of things that, you know, are out because they're so affected by social conditions. I'm not sure if you can put the onus on people who run the city to address that, which I think is part of what Mayor Barrett is trying to tell people.
You think
know, there are a lot of things that are essentially out of government's control.
You think that's maybe up to bigger dogs?
Well, it might be, yeah. Very, very well might be.
Do Milwaukee's challenges come from being a poorly run state? I mean, you're talking about these bigger factors. Are you talking about, you know, the government then? That maybe we've got something that's sweeping across the country and it's not fair to point a finger at Milwaukee?
Well, Milwaukee, in my experience, having lived in just a couple other different cities, grown up in back east in Philadelphia, I've spent some time in California, and then, you know, other parts of the city for other parts of the country for short amounts of time. I've lived in Milwaukee for close to 30 years, and my comparison of these other with the way things are run here and in other parts of the country, particularly the East Coast and the Washington, D.C. area, you don't really see that much difference because people are in an extreme state everywhere nowadays, or in a lot of major cities these days. So a lot of the unemployment and poverty and education, what city, what major city doesn't have a big problem with their public education system these days. And particularly us, we here in the Midwest, we have situations that are endemic to our geographic location and the Rust Belt phenomenon and the loss of jobs to warmer and different parts of the country. So, I mean, how much control does the government have, the local government have, over those kind of factors? And I think Wisconsin and Milwaukee are a very fascinating place to kind of figure out where we can try to solve some of these things. And it's going to depend on leadership. And I think the reason people responded to this study is because it seems like a real indictment of leadership. Worst run. When you tell somebody you're the worst run city or one of 10 worst run cities, that's a real indictment on the people who are allegedly running the city. So I understand why it's getting this much buzz, but my attitude is that it's not that much different in other places, so maybe people shouldn't really freak out about it, but just still don't ignore it. Don't, you know, ignore the real substantive issues that were raised in this study.
Eugene, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts.
Oh, well, thank you for the invitation.
We've been speaking with Eugene Kane. He's a Milwaukee-based columnist. We've been talking about Milwaukee's recent ranking as the 10th worst-run city in the country.
Up next, we consider Congress's action or inaction in 2013 and begin taking a look on what's on the agenda this year, including this week's action on unemployment reform.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The United States Congress is back to work in the new year after a 2013 marked by historic levels of inaction. In 2013, the words gridlock and partisanship became almost synonymous with congressional politics, culminating in that 16-day government shutdown.
Now, at the start of a congressional election year, Congress's approval rating stands at a mere 13%. In response this year, we'd like to shine a light on the workings of Congress and really see where government is and is not working. We'll ask who's getting what done, where the obstacles lie, and explore possibilities for compromise.
And ask, will 2014 be the year that Congress gets its act together? Or will next November see a frustrated electorate ready to shake things up?
Joining us in our exploration of Congress is USA Today politics and Congress editor Paul Singer. He also runs the blog How Government Works and tweets at Singer News. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Glad to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So, making headlines this week is the Senate's debate on extending unemployment benefits. Yesterday, it looked like the bill might not have a chance of reaching the floor for debate. What happened?
Well, enough Republicans, a half dozen Republicans, voted with all the Democrats to go ahead and bring the bill to the floor, which was kind of a surprise. We thought they might not. Of course, voting to bring it to the floor and voting to pass it are two different things, so don't get your hopes up just yet. But the bill is now sort of center stage. This is the conversation that will be taking place in the next couple of days of whether or not Congress can free up about $6 billion for a three-month extension of unemployment benefits for about 1.3 million people.
Now, looking at those Republicans who voted with Democrats to bring it to the floor, if we look at that, do we say, well, look at that, it's got some bipartisan support, so prospects look pretty good?
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe or no. You know, this is Congress. Just because you voted to, like I said, voted for the debate doesn't mean you voted for the bill. I mean, what's at issue here is the Republicans believe that unemployment and insurance benefits, unemployment benefits, particularly these sort of long-term benefits, this is now extending the benefits you're already entitled to, should be paid for with cuts in other government programs, offset, because otherwise you're just adding to the deficit. Democrats argue, well, no, this is an emergency situation. The economy's still bad. Job growth has not improved fast enough. This, we should just, it's like a when there's a hurricane or a tornado or an earthquake, we just give that money as an emergency relief. We don't ask for it to be offset with cuts someplace else. That is the philosophical problem. You have the two parties having a very different view of this. And I honestly don't know what's going to happen because I think everybody wants to show compassion for people who remain unemployed. But the Republicans feel like we can't continue to simply extend and extend and extend and extend these benefits without cuts somewhere else to pay for it.
Well, they have been extended, what, something like 11 times already. Is there a reason that this particular time might be harder or easier?
Well, harder because they already expired. Since the benefits already expired at the end of December, you are now more or less retroactively reinstating them back to the end of December. You know what I mean? It's easier to keep a program alive than it is to resuscitate it once it's dead. And that's the first problem. The second problem is that in general they do these things in other bills. So there's other sweeteners, as we like to call them. You know, if you're going to fund the entire government and then you stick unemployment inside that, well, then no one's going to vote against the entire bill just because they have a philosophical argument. Well, here, now you've got a standalone bill. And so it's much tougher to pass that. One of the reasons Congress doesn't get anything done is because they can't pass standalone bills on anything unless they're full of sweeteners.
And what about philosophical reasons? We talked a little bit about that, about not wanting to add to the deficit, but do you get the sense that there are Republicans that seem genuinely in favor of passing this bill?
Yeah. No, I don't think, in fact, I would not argue the Republicans oppose the extension of benefits. The opposition comes to extension of benefits with no adjacent cut in spending. And, I mean, I think they can be accused, and they will be accused by Democrats, of a lack of compassion, right? But they argue the reverse, that it is more compassionate to, cut the deficit so that you're not burdening the next generation. Also, the Republicans are arguing that they have other jobs bills out there that would actually create jobs that would be more beneficial than just extending unemployment benefits, and that those jobs have languished because the Democratic Senate doesn't want to pick them up.
What concessions will Republicans look for from Democrats if they do end up passing this bill?
Well, that is the magic question. That is the point of debate today in the Senate, is exactly what concessions they would need to sign on. Will they, you know, want a specified set of cuts in various programs? Do they want, at the moment, frankly, the argument is over a whole bunch of Senate procedure. Oh, we need the right to bring up this amendment or that amendment. Senator McConnell yesterday tried to bring up an amendment that would delay the implementation of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. You might not be surprised to know that did not go anywhere. And that's the sort of thing that Democrats say, well, if you're going to do that kind of grandstanding, then to heck with you. We're just going to pass the bill, ram it down your throats, and move on. This is where you get into the fact that these guys just can't work together very well.
And Republicans, some of them, have been saying that this bill is a distraction from Obamacare, and it's political posturing on the part of the Democrats. Is rhetoric like that getting in the way, or is that just business as usual?
I think that is just where we are. I mean, you are in a extraordinarily divided political climate. Nobody ever makes a mistake in this Congress. You simply commit sins and transgressions, right? Nobody is ever wrong on an issue. They are philosophically criminally wrong on an issue. I mean, it's everything becomes end of the world rhetoric, and nobody wants to sit down and say, well, you know, we could probably work with you guys on this. Why don't we try this? There's just nothing to be gained from sitting down and agreeing. People make money off of screaming at each other and calling them evil.
Wow.
Yeah, no,
that
man.
That sounds hopeful.
I've been doing this a long time, man.
Well, let's talk about how the bill might proceed, should it proceed. What are some of the options that might happen?
It's hard. Well, here's what we think might happen, but forgive me that honestly, because the Senate, as you may or may not know, operates without any real rules, all of this is hypothesis, right? It could change tomorrow. One thing that could happen is the Democrats and Republicans could agree, let's vote on a couple of Republican amendments and then pass the bill, right? That would give Republicans an opportunity to sort of air their options, probably lose, and then have a final vote on the bill, which may or may not pass. That is, I think, the path they would like to be able to take, get that done by the end of this week, and then offer it to the House. Keep in mind, the House of Representatives has made no real indication they want to take this thing up anyway. The other possibility, which is uglier, is that they can't come to an agreement, and then we get to another 60-vote threshold cloture vote, another filibuster. I expect some of this to resolve by the end of this week. I think the Senate wants to be done with this by the end of the week. Keep in mind, you know, they still have to get around to actually funding the government, which in theory, runs out of money next Tuesday.
All right, that sounds pretty important, too.
Yeah, right. One would hope.
All right, a lot going on. Paul, thank you so much for helping us sort it out today. Appreciate you joining us.
It is my pleasure, and I certainly apologize if I gave you a sense of doom and gloom. It's all fun.
No, I'm terribly optimistic. Thank you so much. That was Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today, and we've been talking with him about the inside workings of Congress.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll hear from an advocate who says schools should let kids read whatever they want.
Then we'll take a scientific look at how our bodies experience emotions.
And we'll visit the Eagle River Ice Castle in tomorrow's Curious Wisconsin segment.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Still to come after the news, we'll hear about the challenges and opportunities facing state governments and where Wisconsin fits in. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at a new report that lays out potential options for keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes and the cost associated with those options.
First, we are planning to take a look at the trends and big issues facing states and state legislatures, including Wisconsin, in the coming year, pegged to a new report from the Pew Charitable Trusts. We hope to have the guest with us in just a few moments, but we'll throw things up to you at this point. What do you think is the most important issue facing the state of Wisconsin in 2014? Call in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
And don't forget, you can always post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. You can help us get a head start on the issues facing Wisconsin in particular, a lot that the state has been looking at. And you can let us know what's on your mind. What are the big issues in Wisconsin? Are you looking at jobs creation? Are you looking at the economy? Are you looking at the frac sand debate going on? Let us know on our Facebook page.
And is there an issue that will matter to you in the elections for governor? For your state legislators, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234 or send us an email, talk@wpr.org.
That's 800-642-1234. We are getting close to having our guest, I think. But in the meantime, we'd love to hear from you as we work on that. The issues facing Wisconsin, what matters to you in the coming years? Again, in an election year coming up. And what's going to be on your mind as you sit down, you talk with folks? What are you thinking about? What's top on your list that matters here in Wisconsin?
Well, the Pew Charitable Trust released their annual 2014 State of the State series. That's actually coming out throughout the course of the week. Found that healthcare budgets and privacy concerns are among the top challenges facing states. We're joined now by Scott Greenberger. He's the editor of Stateline, the daily news service of the Pew Charitable Trust. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's start with the issue of healthcare. It's big, been looming large on the national scene throughout the course of the year. What are the big challenges in 2014 that states are going to be grappling with?
Well, there are many states that are still trying to decide whether they want to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So that is certainly going to be an issue in those states. Even in the states that have made their decision on that particular point, there will be continuing challenges in implementing the law. As everybody knows, the rollout of the Affordable Care Act was anything but smooth, and so states are trying to fix some of the problems with their exchanges, and also those that are expanding Medicaid are going to have to work hard to integrate a lot of new people into the healthcare system. And then in Wisconsin, of course, you have a little bit of a different situation where Governor Walker is trying to, rather than expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, he's trying to make adjustments to Badger Care in order to provide expanded coverage to more people.
Are we in a big boat in Wisconsin? Are a lot of states doing similar things to what we're doing here?
Well, it's interesting. I think Wisconsin is a little bit of a special case. There are some other states that have not yet expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, but which are considering kind of a hybrid approach to doing that. In other words, they would take the federal Medicaid money, but then use that money to help people buy insurance private insurance on the exchanges rather than enrolling them in Medicaid. And there are several states that are they would need federal approval to do that, but there are several states that are considering that option. One is Pennsylvania. Michigan and Iowa have already won federal approval for that strategy. Tennessee is another state that's considering it.
And of course, and we'll keep coming back to this, I think, this is going to be an election year in Wisconsin and many of the states you cover in your report. A lot of Republican governors probably don't want to be seen as too affiliated with President Obama's health care plan. Maybe some Democrats even don't want to be too closely tied to the troubled rollout. How's that going to affect how states deal with the issue?
Oh, well, I think, you know, politics will absolutely be a big part of the health care decisions that governors and legislatures make moving forward. As you noted, there are several very high-profile Republican governors who are facing tough reelection fights, and Governor Walker is one of those, but also John Kasich in Ohio, Rick Scott in Florida, Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania. All of them are dealing in one way or another with this, or grappling with this issue of Medicaid expansion and Obamacare, and they're treading very carefully, in part for political reasons. And of course, in Wisconsin, you have the added factor of Scott Walker being mentioned as a possible presidential candidate in 2016. So there, the politics is even more complicated.
We invited our listeners to call in and share their top issues for the state of Wisconsin this year at 800-642-1234. And we have Don on the Don in Waukesha to bring one of those issues up. Don, hi, you're on the air. Don, are you there? Don is not there. Evidently, he wanted to bring up the issue of job creation, though. He says manufacturing is potentially a big issue, but a small business creation he wanted to bring up. But what does job creation look like as you look, Scott, at states across the country?
Well, that's going to be a huge issue in just about every state. Many of the states are in the midst of what I would describe as a modest, and many others have described as a modest recovery. I mean, they're not adding jobs at a tremendous clip, but there is some expectation that 2014 will be a slightly better year than the previous couple of years in terms of job creation. Wisconsin, for example, according to an analysis by Moody's Analytics, is expected to add approximately 42,000 jobs in 2014, and that would represent a growth rate, a job growth rate of about 1.49%. That puts Wisconsin kind of in the middle of the pack among the states. I think the exact rank is 32, but it is certainly better than what the state was experiencing during the recession or the years immediately following it. And also, I think it's important and fair to note that while the U.S. unemployment rate is down to 7%, in Wisconsin it's only 6.3%. So clearly there'll be a lot of push and pull between Governor Walker and Democrats over whether Wisconsin's job creation record is a good one or one that needs to be improved upon. And if I'm not mistaken, Governor Walker also made a very specific promise to add, I think, 250,000 new jobs during his first term. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of talk about whether he has achieved that goal when it comes to the election in the fall.
Another thing we see when it comes to states and jobs is competition among states to bring in job creators. Our Governor Walker has made pitches in Illinois and Minnesota to try to get businesses to move across the border. Lately, we've seen a big competition among states to bring a Boeing production facility. How big an issue is that for states to try to cherry pick and lure businesses into their borders?
That's a huge issue. Another governor who comes to mind who's been very out front in trying to do that is Rick Perry of Texas, who's run ads in states, other states, trying to convince businesses located there to move to Texas. And of course, there are a variety of ways that that states try to lure businesses. They try to reduce regulation. They offer tax incentives, and those can be controversial as well. I think everybody in just about every state would like to see more jobs in the state, but the question is, what do states have to do to lure those businesses within their borders, and whether it's worth it. So I think that is likely to be a very big part of this job creation debate in 2014 in many states.
And you end up having dueling tax codes, kind of, as states bandy those about, or the higher tax states say, yeah, well, you pay a little more, but we've got a better lifestyle, quality of life for your workers. Is it hard for a business to compare that kind of apples and oranges?
I would think that it is, yeah. I mean, you've got a lot of different factors. I mean, we mentioned regulations and taxes, but, yeah, weather factors into it, the education systems of various states and the ability of a state to produce the sort of skilled, educated workers that a company might need, all of that factors into those sort of location decisions.
And, again, let's bring it back to elections 2014. Job creations, you mentioned Governor Walker's job pledge. These are issues, I imagine, that are going to be in state elections around the country.
Oh, absolutely. I think that even with the recovery of many of the jobs lost during the recession, and I believe the country as a whole has replaced something on the order of 80% of the jobs that were lost during the recession. You know, that's not all of the jobs, and there are still many, many people who are unemployed. The big debate here in Washington today, of course, is over the extension of or whether to extend unemployment benefits that have expired. So I think that jobs will continue to be at the very top of the agenda in all of the top issues in all of the political races around the country.
And do you think it'll even trump the healthcare issue that we started with?
It's tough to choose one. I'd say if I had to pick the two biggest, it would be those two. Healthcare, of course, affects many, many people in a very personal way, and it also has a lot to do with state budgets, and both now and moving forward. And so I think that those are two issues that will be prominent in almost every state.
We're talking with Scott Greenberger about the issues facing states and state legislatures in 2014, and we want to hear from you. What do you think will be the top issue states will have to grapple with in the coming year? And what about here in Wisconsin in particular? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now with Scott Greenberger about the issues facing states in the coming year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've touched on healthcare and job creation. What do you think will be the big issue facing state governments in 2014 and in Wisconsin in particular? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Scott, we have an email from Jeff and Rhinelander who wants to know about collective bargaining. That's been a huge issue here in Wisconsin over the last couple of years. There's been talk about right-to-work laws emerging maybe this year in the state. Where is that on the national map of state priorities?
One of the issues that we're examining this week, but of course that was a gigantic issue in Wisconsin. I guess it's a couple of years ago now, but it also has become an issue in some of the other states that traditionally have been very strong pro-union states, including Michigan, where Governor Rick Snyder has also made steps in that direction. So I think that also could be an issue in 2014. And I think that's related to an issue that we are looking at, which is the fiscal condition of the various states and their budget situations. And while overall all 50 states together have now reached their peak revenues from before the recession, some individual states have not, and I think that many of them will be continuing to look for ways to save money. I know in Wisconsin that the most recent biennial budget includes, I think, a $650 million income tax cut, and the passage of the budget in Wisconsin, this current budget, was a lot less contentious than the last one. I think that holds true in many states because Generally speaking, their fiscal situations are improved, but certainly they will be continuing. Things are still tight, and I wouldn't describe most of them as flush, and therefore they will continue to be looking for ways to save money, and certainly that could lead to disputes with various public employee unions and other unions in 2014.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Saeed with us in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Yes. I think your speaker was referring to the fact that jobs have come back, but what he's not taking into account is that high-paying jobs have been replaced by low-paying jobs, and American prosperity is significantly down. You can see evidence of that all over, and I think the root cause of that is the health care law. The health care law's impact on employment is going to be felt very deeply. I personally carry a high deductible insurance. I'm willing to pay for the first $10,000 of my medical care. My premiums went up 40% on a very high deductible insurance policy.
All right, Saeed. I don't know, Scott, if you want to get into the causes behind the changes in the nature of jobs, but the nationwide transition, probably mostly here in the manufacturing Midwest, or formerly manufacturing Midwest, from higher-paying jobs to lower-paying jobs, that's got to be something that weighs on tax bases of a lot of states.
Well, I think that is true. Nationally, many of the jobs that are expected to be growing most rapidly in, over the next 10 years or so are healthcare jobs, but some of them are relatively low-paying healthcare jobs, personal care aides, those sort of jobs. And the combination of bringing many millions of people under health insurance as part of the Affordable Care Act, combined with the aging of the U.S. population, makes it likely that the need for healthcare jobs will continue to be pretty great for the foreseeable future.
Another topic you cover in your reports from the Pew Centers is gay marriage. And there's been a big change there from two states with legal gay marriage just a handful of years ago up to 17. Are we going to see more movement on that front around in states around the country this year?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've written, obviously, there's been a tremendous change over the past several years, and not just, well, it reflects the equally dramatic change in people's attitudes nationally toward that issue. I mean, there's been a tremendous transformation in how people view same-sex marriage. But that said, a lot of the states that have not approved it yet are states where public opposition remains pretty strong, or they are states where there is some sort of legal or constitutional prohibition against same-sex marriage. So we are predicting that for the foreseeable future, that this very rapid kind of turning that's happened over the past 2, 3, 4 years might slow down. Now, of course, it's unpredictable because who would have thought that Utah would be a state in the news or at the forefront of the same-sex marriage issue anytime soon? Some people might have guessed it would be the last state. And yet here we are with that emerging as an issue in that state. So I think that people's views are changing so quickly on that issue that it's very difficult to predict what might happen. But I think it's fair to assume that it will continue to be an issue that is debated in state houses and in the public square in states around the country.
As I recall, Wisconsin, when we got our constitutional amendment forbidding gay marriage in the state, we were part of that. Was a wave. That was a wave among a lot of states of passing that kind of constitutional amendment where it was possible to do so.
That's right. There are many states that have those, but now the wave is heading in the other direction. So it's really a fascinating issue. It's difficult to think of another issue where the public's views have changed so dramatically and rapidly in such a short amount of time.
Another part of your report concerns privacy. At the federal level, of course, the NSA revelations from Edward Snowden have a lot of people thinking about government surveillance, government tracking of data, of our information. How does that affect the states? That isn't something I would have thought of.
Well, it's interesting. States and state lawmakers can't do very much about the NSA, which of course is a federal entity, and that debate will play out in Washington around the country, but there's not much that state lawmakers can do about the NSA or that kind of surveillance directly. However, there are a lot of other issues related to privacy that state lawmakers can and in all likelihood will deal with, and Wisconsin is certainly one of the states where that's happening. I'm thinking of new technologies such as drones, which many police departments are increasingly interested in using for surveillance and other crime-fighting purposes. And there's a real concern out there about how that technology might be abused or how it might infringe upon people's civil liberties. Similarly, and I think Representative David Craig in Wisconsin is pushing this, there's concern over license plate readers, which are kind of scanners or cameras mounted on police cars or on road signs, which law enforcement can use to record the license plates of cars that pass by and then also the time and location. And of course, that is a way that they can figure out where a certain person is or was at a certain time. And while that certainly has some law enforcement advantages, there are also concerns about specifically how long they might keep that data and what else it might be used for. I believe the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did a big piece on that not so long ago. So I think that's something that's very much on the radar screen in Wisconsin, but many other states.
Here's one not part of your report, I don't think, but a listener named Mariette wants Wisconsin and other states to tackle redistricting reform, how we allocate our districts and gerrymander and that sort of thing. Is that something that's coming up in your experience in other states as well?
You know, that is a very interesting issue, and of course that's directly related. Some would say it's the primary reason for the gridlock that we are experiencing here in Washington. I believe that that is not one of the issues we look at in this series, but I believe that Iowa and California, I think, are the two states that have turned over that responsibility, the responsibility of drawing districts, to a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission. And there certainly are a lot of people out there who believe that that would be an excellent way to address the polarization of the parties. And the idea is that if the districts weren't drawn in such a way that they were so heavily Democratic and heavily Republican, that the candidates running for office in those districts, both in state for state office or for a federal office, so Congress, would have to appeal to the middle instead of just appealing to their bases, and that therefore we would be electing more moderates who would presumably be more willing to deal with each other once they got to Washington or were in state capital. So I think, again, that's not an issue we looked at, but that's one to watch, because I think that there are an increasing number of people who believe that that could be part of the answer to improving the political climate in Washington.
Briefly, a related issue, we have one-party rule in Wisconsin, Republican governor, Republican legislature. Is that the norm across the country now?
Well, it has been recently. There are 24 states where Republicans hold both the governor's office and both chambers of the legislature, and there are 12 states where Democrats are in that position. And the result has been a flurry of action on a whole host of issues that that the lawmakers in Washington haven't been able to take action on. And I think that it'll be interesting to see whether that trend continues. And, of course, the states that are democratically controlled have gone in a very blue direction on a number of issues, whether it's gun control or even immigration issues, election-related issues, whereas Republican-dominated states have gone in the opposite direction. So that'll be interesting to watch. But it really is a striking phenomenon, and accentuates the differences right now between what's going on in state capitals and what's going on in Washington.
Lots to watch in the states this year. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Scott Greenberger. He's editor of Stateline, the daily news service of the Pew Charitable Trusts.
Coming up after the news, a new report lays out options to try and keep ancient carp out of the Great Lakes. But what's the cost? I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.